Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 142 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet Michael Blackburn speaks with Jeff Hattersley about his literary origins, his antipathy to the establishment, and being the former enfant, now grand-père terrible, of the British poetry scene.
It's often said that a poet's work deserves wider recognition. This has never been truer than in Michael Blackburn's case, who has been a force to be reckoned with in British poetry since the 1970s. As both a writer and editor, he has never been afraid to ignore what's fashionable and go out on a limb. And Neil Astley, the chief editor of Blood Axe Books, once referred to him as the enfant terrible of British poetry due to his scathing views on the establishment. His publications include The Constitution of Things and The Ascending Boy, and, more recently, Spyglass Over the Lagoon, a 300-page collection containing work written during a four-year spell when Michael drove himself to write a poem every day. I spoke to Michael at his home in Lincoln. Okay, so nice to see you again, Michael. And I thought I'd start by asking how you got interested in poetry. Is it something you were interested in as a schoolboy, or did it come later?
It started fairly early on, when I think back to it. I'd always wanted to be a writer, strangely enough, even before I could actually write. That was because my father had always wanted to be a journalist and a writer, but he never achieved that for various reasons. His father had been a professional journalist in Darlington, so I think he kind of inherited a liking for writing and a desire to do it. This grandfather wrote prose and he was into sport, so it's not really the kind of stuff that I'm interested in. But he did leave a booklet of clippings of little kind of thoughts that he used to write for this paper, which it was called Stories from the Park, and it was about things that he noticed when he walked around South Park in Darlington. So this had always formed a part of my life. My father was a great reader, and I enjoyed reading books as well. I remember having one of those little red notebooks, little lined notebooks that you used to get in those days.
Yeah, I remember them, yeah. Memo books.
Yeah, that kind of thing. And I used to write in it, but I couldn't actually write. So they were just like squiggles. And these were my stories. And I'd open it up, and then I just, because there weren't any words, I just kind of made it up each time I looked at it. And then later, as I did learn to write properly, I did write these very, obviously, extremely childish stories. And it sort of went on from there. But the poetry bit, I'm not really sure when the infection got me. I think it must have been early on, but certainly by the time I went to grammar school, I was really hooked on poetry, because I remember in my first year there was a society, and it was pretentiously called Bardic Society, and I went along to that. Usually there was just two of us and one of the teachers who was very interested in writing, and I just got into writing stuff that you do at that age, atrocious kind of stuff, and it just never went away. But everything I wrote up until I was about mid-20s was rubbish. And so in many ways, I'm a bit of a late starter, I think.
So sometimes in the 70s, you went to Leeds University to study English literature, yeah?
Yes, I did. I had a year off between finishing school and going to university, and I worked part of that time in a local hospital, which was really interesting, quite an eye-opener. And then I went to Leeds. I decided when I was applying to universities that Leeds was the place. There was just something about it that appealed to me, partly it was the tradition that it had of fostering writers, particularly poets. So I thought, well, this sounds like a good place to go. And I went for the interview and I got accepted at the interview and I said yes straight away. Because there are times when you know this is the right place. And I spent three great years at Leeds trying to write poetry, but not doing it very well still. Part of that was, strangely enough, that most of the friends I had weren't English students. And now when I think back on it, I think this is very odd. Most of my friends were kind of engineers and chemists. It's sort of bizarre. Yeah. Kind of thing. I think it's to do with the fact that they like drinking quite a lot, which at the time I quite enjoyed drinking and carousing and stuff.
Who doesn't? Yeah.
You know, and so I didn't really get to know any English students, which is very strange. So I never really got involved at that stage with any activities. It was only when I did the MA that, first of all, I met other students who were really really interested in literature, but were also interested in writing as well. So one of the other students I met, for instance, was a guy, an American from New York State called Michael Coffey. And we all, together, we co-edited a translations issue of Poetry and Audience. And Poetry and Audience was the long-standing poetry magazine from the School of English.
Yeah, I remember it.
And it had been going for years, by the time I arrived, and at that stage, I thought it's about time I started to do something. So they were looking for new people to join the editorial board. So I went along to the meeting. There was a stack of other people there. We basically effected a kind of coup, and ejected the two people who had been running it for quite a while. Yeah. I won't mention any names because it rankled with them for quite a while. So there was a kind of new broom, as it were, with Poetry and Audience. And at the meeting, the first meeting of the new regime, there was Ken Smith. And Ken had arrived as the Yorkshire Arts Writing Fellow at Leeds University.
Right.
And we just sort of met, we talked, and we got on. And he was there for anybody who was interested in going to him to talk about the poetry, and I went along to him and showed him stuff. And in a way, what happened was he just said something very simple about the poems, because most of my poems just didn't, they were just ragbags of stuff. And he just said a simple thing, which was, you've got to find what it is that's driving the poem. Very simple. What is it really? What is it about, and where it's going? But that was enough. It just sort of clicked something in my brain. And that's after then I started to be able to write decent poems.
So when I first met you, Michael, you were living in Newcastle. How did you end up there?
I was living down in London and desperate to get out because I'd lost my job. And this was the very early 80s. And I decided that I didn't like London particularly. I wanted to get out, so I moved back up north, and I moved back up to Darlington so I could kind of crash out my parents' place. And I got a flat underneath where they were living, and it's one of these long kind of strange situations. I found that Darlington had an art centre, which surprised me immensely, because Darlington was not really the most go-ahead town at the time. So I went along to a workshop run by a poet, and it was really good. I showed him some poems, and he said, "Well, these are, I think these are publishable quality and everything like that." And I thought that was quite nice. And he said, we talked a bit, and I said I'd been to Leeds and I'd been on the editorial board of Poetry and Audience and things. And he said, "Well, if you're interested, I could put you in touch with John Silkin at Stand, because one of their editors has left." And I said, "Yeah, that'd be really interesting. That'd be fine. It'd be great." At the same time, I actually got a job in Newcastle working at the university and it was working for Robert Wolf, who ran the Wordsworth Heritage Scheme, which included Dove Cottage over in Grasmere. So these things both happened at exactly the same time. So I ended up working on the Wordsworth Heritage thing, transcribing 19th century manuscripts for Robert Wolf, and then in the evenings, occasionally going around to the stand area where John Silkin lived and starting to do some editorial stuff. But then at the same time, Stand magazine had acquired a lot of money or accumulated it over the years and actually bought a house in Newcastle just for the magazine. So I ended up having a place to live, which then housed the magazine. Mm. And not long after that, Brendan Cleary moved up. He'd already been selling magazines down south, and but he was based in London, and then he moved up to Newcastle to the house. So the house then had two poets, budding poets in it, and everything else.
And about the same time, you all started your own press, Jackson's Arms.
Yeah, that I started on Stand in 1982, and then I think it was 1985 or 1986. I can't remember. Because Brendan and I, obviously, we've been talking about stuff that was going on poetry and how some of the work that we would like to have put into Stand wouldn't get in, you know. And in fact, I think one of the first was your poem, The Deep End. It was one of the ones that we thought, we'll never get it through the Stand procedures, but it ought to get published somewhere. And it was just like, he started with the Echo Room, and I set up Jackson's Arm Press, but they're kind of at the same time. Mm. So I started publishing poetry pamphlets. Brendan started publishing the magazine. Then he started doing pamphlets as well. So they're like, there's a kind of excrescence from the Stand place. But very quickly, I mean, we both left very soon after that to go on different routes.
Yeah, I remember Neil Astley back then called you the enfant terrible of British poetry. Yeah. Do you think that were you comfortable with that tag? I mean, do you think it was fair?
I think it's quite handy. I now call myself grand père terrible because I'm old. Right. Well, yes. I mean, I think it was a bit of a pain for a lot of people because I just argue with a lot of people, particularly in what we call the establishment. Because I thought there was a lot of stuff that was going on that wasn't being acknowledged. Yeah, and there was so much writing that was good, but different. And there were a lot of people doing things and they should have been picked up by, you know, bigger publishers. The whole thing should have been given more acknowledgement. My view of this is that we were the kind of people that were doing this. We were writing, we were trying out different ways of writing, and we were doing the publishing, we were just setting things up in our living rooms or whatever. We were putting out magazines, pamphlets, we were organising readings, we were the ones who were doing workshops, getting together with other people and stuff. The kind of establishment, if you can call it that, weren't doing anything. They were doing absolutely nothing. You know, in fact, they were ignoring it as much as possible, but then it sort of clicked that they were missing a trick. Okay, and I think Blood Axe obviously realised this because one of the first things they did was to publish a collection. I think it's called Poets with an Edge or Poetry with an Edge or something like that, yeah. Which was a Blood Axe poet. And then, of course, there was the New Generation stuff, which was just like they realised that they had to get in on the act. And I think once they did that, it was finished because now they'd kind of moved in. They were saying, these are the new people,
yeah,
rather than every, you know. And I think that's why it was a very brief kind of window where this sort of happened, and then of course it just went on from there. So what happened was, whereas we used to complain about the same faces turning up who were older people, some of them decent poets obviously, but it's just like it's the same people turning up. It just changed so that now it was the same people, but they were just 20 years younger than the other lot.
Yeah.
And I think it's just continued like that, to be quite honest.
Well, I'm interested in a project that you involved yourself in fairly recently when you allegedly wrote a poem every day for 4 years, which, if my maths is right, would be 1,461 poems. So were all these poems genuinely all finished in one day? None of them were revised or altered in any way at all later?
Most of them were as written and have remained as such. A couple of them I have altered very slightly, but not greatly, if I've pulled them out to include somewhere else, occasionally an anthology. But most of them are as written.
Right.
And it lasted 4 years. And what I would do was, I usually wrote them at night in bed, because at the time I had a nice, very small mini tablet thing, which I just used for that. So I'd just lie there in bed and I just write something. And I'd got to the stage where I didn't want to write ordinary poems anymore. I think most of us get this kind of feeling that, you know, after a while, I'm just doing the same stuff, or I'm just using the same way of writing. And I've always resisted that. I've always liked to try different things. So I thought, I don't care now. I'm just going to write whatever appeals to me at that time. And it could just be a single image that I've seen or has come into my mind. Or it could just be a particular phrase or combination of phrases that does something and creates a little bit of magic. Or it could be something I've read. It could be something I'm looking at, and I want to do the kind of appropriation thing of rearranging phrases and things from it, which can be really exciting, very interesting way of doing things. It could just be absolutely anything, and it was a kind of freeing up of the imagination. So I just got into the habit of doing that. Most of them, obviously, are quite short.
Yeah, some of them are very short.
Which is fine. Some of them are just a couple of lines, and I think... That's great, because most poetry goes on for too long. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having really short poems. So
though there's still in some quarters a lot of resistance to seeing that kind of thing as poetry, isn't there? You know?
Yeah.
Despite the fact that it's been done for years, really, since the 70s.
Yes.
Tom Roth did that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, I know Knife, Forks and Spoons brought out quite a big selection of these. How was the book received? Were there any reviews?
Yeah, I think it probably bankrupted him, but no. I don't know how many reviews it actually did get. It did get one review that I've got in the Salzburg Poetry Review, which was very good.
Right.
It was really great review, actually. And the reviewer kind of picked up on different aspects of the whole project. But also, he was actually saying that these are poems, that they may look like they're just kind of quick jottings, but when you look, he got into more of the technicalities than I did, actually, in terms of the rhythms and stuff.
Yeah.
But that was nice to have somebody sort of acknowledge that, yes, they were poems. It's just that perhaps people don't, you know, people get into all these kind of difficulties about definitions. And with this, I didn't give a shit, actually, put it that way.
Yeah.
I didn't care anymore. I just want to do this.
So when you describe it as a project, did you set out to write every day for 4 years, or did that just happen after you'd begun?
It just sort of carried on.
Until you had enough.
I started because the thing that set me off was I was thinking about time. Because as you get older, you have less of it to look forward to. And it struck me, in terms of memories, when you have a you remember something, there's two things which are both incredibly short. One is the actual thing that you remember. You don't actually remember a very long period of something. If you have a memory, it's actually seconds of something, isn't it? It's actually really short. And the other thing is that the act of remembering is also very short. So you might think you have lots of memories, but if you could actually put them together, they'd probably only last about 10 minutes or something frightening like that. And you think, well, maybe a few hours. I don't know. You know, if you put them all together for like 40 years worth of memories, and then it just struck me, it's rather frightening, in fact, that every single day is basically lost because you can't, you remember little bits, but then after a while you just forget. So there's whole days of your life, weeks, and you don't remember anything. And I thought this would be one way of just capturing bits, some bit from every day.
Yeah.
Either that something that happened, or as I said before, some kind of image or idea that came to you. So that's how it started, and I just thought I'll do it every day and see how it goes, and maybe I should do it for a year if I can. And it just went on, and then I got to the end of 4 years, and I thought, I think I need a rest.
Right.
And
I imagine you did, yeah. So what have you been working on since that project? You've still gone and moved into found poetry.
Yeah. I kind of got to the point where I thought, well, I don't want to just write the sort of stuff that I used to write. I thought, I'm still fascinated by how language works, and it links back really to my kind of earlier years where I was interested in kind of experimental stuff and kind of late modernists, and I started to reread and read people like Tom Raworth, for instance, and thinking, I really like this stuff. You know, I don't always know what's going on, but it doesn't actually matter. It's just really exciting, and there's something about those different ways of writing which still I find it intriguing. So I don't know how it happened. It started quite a few years ago. I started sort of reading through stuff and then picking phrases out of the texts and then joining them together and playing around with them, and they made a kind of parallel text or a new poem out of the words that already were there.
Yeah.
So the first one I did, a full thing I did, it was called Let's Build the City, which is taken from the autobiography of T. Dan Smith, who's a notorious figure from the northeast of England from the 60s and 70s. And I went through it chapter by chapter and took certain phrases and things out and made them into separate poems. So, and then I just kept doing it with different books and different types of writing. There's two unpublished collections awaiting appearance. One is called Said Marlowe Suddenly, which is, I went through the whole of Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which is one of my favourite novels. It's just fantastic. And I used that process on it. So I created this long single poem, which is a kind of weird kind of reflection or maybe a shadow of the original. And that got accepted by a new press. I'm still waiting for that actually to get to publication, but I'm looking forward to that. And then I did another sequence of poems, which I haven't bothered putting out except on my blog, called In the World, the Clarkson poems, which are similar to that, but there's a bit more kind of extra creativity in them. I've got a volume of Jeremy Clarkson's articles from 10, 12 years back from the Sunday Times or something. And I went through those and I started to create poems out of those because they're quite bizarre and interesting. So if there's anybody out there wants to publish a pamphlet of reworked Clarkson poem stuff, just get in touch. And the last thing is not a collection, it's a single poem called Albion Days, which is, it's taken from a 19th century essay by a writer called Mary Mitford. I don't think she's any connection with the later Mitfords, but she was a very successful writer from the early part of the 19th century. I think she actually knew people like Jane Austen and so on. But she used to write particularly about rural life in the country, and there's a collection of her articles, essays. And I read one of them and I thought it'd be really interesting to do the same process. So I went through it and I selected particular phrases and then organised it. So again, it was like a long poem. But then I thought, why not do something different to it? And I thought, why not play around with the typography and the size of the type? I don't know why I thought of that. It just these things come into your mind. So I kind of expanded the typeface from the ordinary 12-point to something like 70 or 80. And it has very, I think, very interesting effect on the reading of it, because it looks partly like a child's book because of the big print. It's also got that visual element to it, because now the type becomes a visual thing as well as a kind of verbal thing, and it creates these spaces and with the white of the page and everything else. And also, if you start to read it, it slows it down. If you are trying to read it page by page, it really slows down the way that you look at it and read it. And I just like that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, so it's that kind of, that's a bit of the enfant terrible coming out in me, I think, just being, you know, the kind of slightly devilish approach to things, to do something slightly different.
So do you think you'll get back to writing more traditional type poetry again or not?
You can't always tell. I mean, I'm remaining open to the possibility of returning to that way of writing, certainly. I have a feeling that I may go back to the beginning again with the very short, concise writing, and yet I still have a kind of feeling that there may be something which is longer in the line and more, not discursive, but bigger. I think it depends very much on the kind of material. But I remain open to it because, as you know, you can never really tell what's going to happen. It's like radio silence, and then suddenly you start hearing some transmission. So you just have to be prepared for it. I'd like to be writing more than I do regularly, and I'd be quite happy to write short, slight poems.
Yeah.
And I'd be quite happy to write long ones.
Do you think the world is ready for selected poems, you know, which draws on material from your entire career?
I think it's long overdue, to be quite honest, Jeff. But whether any publisher would be foolhardy enough to venture money on it, I don't know. But I think there's certainly enough material there.
Yeah, I think you should go for that, you know.
Well, if you know any publisher you could bribe to do it.
That was Michael Blackburn in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You can find out more about Michael on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 142, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 143, playwright and screenwriter Johnny Wright considers the sobering parallels between the 1959 play A Raisin in the Sun, featuring a black family in Southside Chicago, and the racial inequality, downward economic mobility, and de facto housing segregation of contemporary London. Then, novelist Kerry Young describes her journey from failing O-level English to becoming a successful novelist, and how her writing is a gift both to her late father and to the diverse cultures that have produced contemporary Jamaica. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.